Are you hanging in? I know it's a marathon. I don't know why I got this image, but I just got an image of a recent event I was at where there were some corporate leaders and a bunch of public school teachers, and the corporate leaders were lecturing the public school teachers that they just didn't like change and they didn't understand things and they should open up to change. And finally, this one man, everybody was very quiet, this one man who was a math teacher and turned around and said, "You know, it really isn't change I don't like, it's you." Lovely images to sustain. Mark Ritchie needs no introduction, a wonderful campaigner that works in Canada as well as here in the U.S. and around the world. Mark is the president of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, a nonprofit and nonpartisan research organization. He's recognized as a leader in the development of innovative trade policy, especially in the fields of environment and agriculture. Mark has spent the last 20 years of his life working to address a wide range of economic, social, and environmental issues facing family farms and small towns around the world. Recently, from 1984 to 88, Mark was an agriculture and trade policy analyst for the State of Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and he's a regular columnist for farm and trade publications in the U.S., Europe, Japan, and Canada, and he's written and produced two films on the environment and agricultural issues. Please welcome Mark Ritchie.
Thank you, Maude. I don't think I have to spend a lot of time tonight detailing the negative, deadly impacts of IMF and World Bank and private lender policies on farmers and food producers, and on those of us who are eaters and consumers. The newspapers have been full of incredible stories. I mean, they're quite blunt. The description this week of the rice farmers in Haiti, crushed by the imports of heavily subsidized rice because of IMF structural adjustment policies, attempting to flee to come over the waters and their boat capsizing and dying. The newspapers are full of other stories as well, and in the back and in the literature, you can read what happened in Indonesia, what happened in Costa Rica, what happened in Russia, what's happened all over the planet. But I think what's probably most important tonight is to try to get behind that a little bit, because, I mean, we know these are loan sharks, so the question is, why do you go to a loan shark? And the thing that's interesting about agriculture and food production and fishing and forestry and some of the other primary industries is that it becomes more clear when you look closely the dynamics by which you can see why governments are forced to go to these loan sharks. Because in agriculture, you're dealing with a situation where the individual producers have often the same experience as the government. By that I mean somebody someplace else in a monopoly corporation, in a ministry of agriculture someplace, is sitting around and controlling prices on what you have to pay to get what you need to farm, seeds and equipment, that kind of thing, and especially controlling the price that you're going to receive for your commodities. And in the case of the last 20 years in particular, there's been a very, very clear pattern in the international market for agricultural products where, in particular, the transnational food corporations based in North America and Europe have used the government, their own national governments, and the IMF and World Bank, the WTO and private lenders, to follow through with an economic strategy of lowering prices far below the cost of production, taking those commodities out onto the world market to very consciously replace farmers and producers in other countries. My own Senator Boschwitz, he's actually now gone from the Senate, I should say, in 1985 in Time magazine was very explicit. He said, "We want the next U.S. farm bill to lower prices so far it will put the farmers of Brazil and Argentina out of business." Now, this is a mentality. It's also a driving force of policy. But there's a couple problems with that idea. Number one, Brazil and Argentina both heavily indebted both to international banks, IMF, and to World Bank, can't just go out of business of producing soybeans and corn because they still have to pay their debts. It's not like the bankers are going to say, oh, Senator Boschwitz wants to put you out of business, so we're just going to forgive your debts. No, it's not like that. In fact, what happened was, in both instances, those countries were forced to lower their prices and to match the U.S. subsidy down to very low levels. And the end result, of course, was that they had to produce more and more and more soybeans and corn, sugar, other commodities, sell a larger volume at that lower price as a way to keep up their cash flow to pay their debts. The destruction of the rainforest, the impoverishment of the producers, and as a result, at the global level, an extreme depression in farm prices. In fact, for some of you who follow this, I think you know, in that period of the 1980s and continuing through today, we've been in a period of extreme economic crisis and very, very low, in fact, for my lifetime, historically low prices for commodities because we've built this system around debt and the attempt to drive down prices far enough to put other producers out of business. But what does happen eventually is that other countries, in particular those who are responsive to and under the thumb of political and foreign policy pressure from the United States and Europe, eventually these low prices do put a lot of small farmers out of business, especially the small farmers who were producing foods for their communities, for themselves, for their country. And as that process happens, those countries, of course, begin to have to import food. And a kind of funny thing happens along the way. You have to import food with hard currency. And you first go out and borrow that hard currency, probably from an international banking consortium, perhaps from the IMF, perhaps at some point from the World Bank. But over time, you can't borrow anymore. And so then you have become then dependent almost exclusively, and you are willing to do anything you are told to maintain that cycle, because these low subsidized agricultural exports have put your farmers out of business and put you into a situation of dependency, so you have no room to maneuver. Now, this whole cycle, this whole process of driving down the price of commodities, you know, be it, you know, mining commodities or agricultural commodities, but creating a situation where countries are seeing their terms of trade declining, going into debt, and then being forced to go first to kind of standard lenders, and as the situation deteriorates, then to go to the real loan sharks at the IMF and World Bank. That dynamic is also the same dynamic that's repeated in the lives of the individual farmers and peasants in those countries, and not just in those countries, also here in the United States as well. When they begin driving down those prices, of course, it's the farmers who are the ones who suffer that result. And farmers themselves go into debt. Perhaps they mortgage their land, or they take on a debt because they're trying to increase their production by adopting the so-called modern farming methods. One of the results of that is that at the end of the season, if you've had a bad weather year or if the price has collapsed and you find yourself unable to pay your debts, you don't have a lot of options. The most disturbing option, and the one that's gotten some coverage in the press, but in no way has the media really picked up on this, but it's the extreme levels of epidemic of suicides that we see both in the North, in the United States and other countries, but also in countries like India and in Sri Lanka. In fact, it's a very, very dramatic in India because it's often done by swallowing the very pesticides that the debts were taken on to try to increase the production to keep up with these lower prices to pay off the debt. It's a cycle that people feel in their personal lives as farmers and in their families that they also can see in the nation. In fact, I think it's because farmers could understand this problem of commodity prices and debt and the way that you end up interlocked, interdependent, and then under the thumb of lenders. that farmers have been often on the cutting edge of the protests and battles. Some of you have paid attention to this in the third world. It's also been true in the United States and other countries. But I think when people have that experience of knowing what it means to go into debt and then to see that turn into the destruction of your very life, they're aware of how that dynamic works at the national level and what these loan sharking institutions are really all about. But the IMF and World Bank, they don't just kind of do this on their own, of course. Particularly in agriculture, they are reflecting very much the policies, the desires, the direction that's coming from the major dominant agricultural exporting nations like the United States, Canada, Europe, as reflective of what the giant corporations who are operating in this arena are really looking for. And for a long time, you know, it wasn't such a stiff hand. In fact, for a long time, there was the attempt to promote the idea of these kind of industrial agricultural models, large-scale monoculture, as sort of a better way of doing things. Trying to convince farmers that it's a better way, you know, more prosperous. Trying to convince countries that this is a better way, you know, tractors, pesticides, artificial fertilizers, that whole thing. But a funny thing happened was along the road, a whole lot of people were able to point out the dangers, the deadliness of some of those approaches, and also just the impossibility of turning nature into an industrial process for any length of time. So the corporations began to back away a little bit from trying to promote this whole idea as something that was better. And they got around to this argument that's really kind of popular right now, which is that it's needed because we've got to feed the world. You know, we're getting this really a lot right now because of all the biotech stuff. But they'll say, you know, yeah, you know, those pesticides, there are problems and so on and so forth. But, you know, we really have to do this to feed the world. And the good news, and agriculture, again, is a little bit unique in this, the 50% of the population of the planet who are farmers, the 99% of those who are farming organically, not in this modern mode, have proven year in and year out for somewhere between 10 and 25,000 years that there are other ways to do it. It's pretty clear on this point. I think some of you in the room probably were tuned in when the U.S. government tried to redefine organic to include, you know, irradiation and genetic engineering and so on and so forth, because, you know, they can't have this. They cannot have. They will shoot you. Organic farmers who were organizing in the Philippines, rural organizers, were shot. I think they lost one a day for a period of time. They will shoot you. But now we're into a new period because there is so much challenge to that kind of thinking. Let's call it the ideology. And that's now they come back and they say, no, you know, it may not be necessarily better, and it may not be needed, but you know, the hell with you. It's inevitable. You know, you can't fight City Hall and you can't fight big business. And the thing that was so remarkable about Seattle, and the thing that's so incredible about the global rejection of this biotechnology scam, is that people have finally begun to demonstrate vividly and in public that what was said to be inevitable is not. And never again will they be able to use that argument. Never again. You know, farmers were the ones who invented this idea of markets. We've kicked around markets quite a bit today, and we do that. And, you know, in every little town and in every city, farmers came together and shared what they had that was extra. And the markets, and most of you have traveled, and most of you probably have visited your own farmers' markets, you know how much markets reflect the vibrancy and the life of people and the whole exchange and interaction. It's amazing. But at some point in this process, some people said, hey, you know, if we could take over that market and monopolize that market, we could make both a bunch of money and have power over others. And so that market began to be monopoly. And at some point, those same people began to say, you know, this market idea isn't such a good idea. In fact, I think what I want is I want the government to give me a patent so I can monopolize an idea for 20 or 25 years. Or you know what? Who really cares what those consumers want to eat? They're going to eat genetically engineered food. Or you know what? These banks and the other institutions need help. Let's take taxpayers' money and create an IMF and a World Bank to bail them out. In other words, at some point in time, the markets that were generated by people were taken over, monopolized, and at some point they began to see clearly that the notion of the market and what the people wanted and what consumers wanted was not something that was going to continue to enrich the handful of people, the small handful of people. And they began to assault the market in really direct ways. And the thing that's happened in this struggle, in this whole struggle about agriculture and food and the whole debate around where they fit in people's lives, is that it has slowly but surely come back out of that sort of grasp of a few people who didn't want it to be part of people's lives, and the conversation has broken open again. You know, at the World Food Summit, the U.S. government tried desperately and in some ways successfully to say, no, there's not a right to food. Just like Maud described, they said, no, there's not a right to water. But most of the world stood up and said, yes, there's a right to food. But more importantly, people stood up and said, more than just a right to food, the production of food, the culture of producing food, is fundamental to maintaining the balance that we need in this fragile planet. And that this industrial model of agriculture wasn't just giving us terrible, deadly food, but was in many ways destroying the knowledge and wisdom that was needed to maintain the kind of ecological and social balance. And so people began to be aware that this industrial model wasn't just producing food that was probably killing us, or at least tasting terrible. It wasn't just displacing small farmers and causing suicides, but it was also going right at the heart and destroying the knowledge and wisdom and experience and the cultural elements that we were going to and we need desperately to try to figure out how to live together on this tiny planet with this many people. And when people began to see that, they began to ask much more fundamental questions about where we were going. And for me, this whole process has begun to open up a debate and discussion that we're now playing out in the room tonight and here over the next few days and in the rest of our lives. And when I think about that process opening up, I'm always reminded, I go back to the political writing that affected me the most, was a doctor named Dr. Cecily Williams, who was a pediatrician in the 1930s, who realized that Nestle and these companies making artificial formula were killing babies. A lot of you know that story. And she gave a speech where she asked the question, was their action murder or manslaughter? Was it conscious or was it accidental and somehow a consequence of this behavior? It took 50 years before people stopped debating whether it was murder or manslaughter, and before a group of people stood up and said, you know, we don't give a damn the answer to the question. What we care about is the solution of the problem. I believe when it comes to the IMF and World Bank, I don't care if it's murder or manslaughter. It is now time to say no to all of that and to move this agricultural system into one that goes back to giving us life, not one that's giving us death. Thank you very much.
You know, All the best people are on our side. All of them. All of them. You don't get any of this at their conferences. I just want to say to anybody who doesn't have a seat, if you're in the aisle and want a seat, there are places. So anybody who's got a spot beside you, you might just put your hand up to let people know they can sit down. And because Susan George is not here, I just want to, in reference to what Mark said about alternatives, what she would say if she were here tonight, she would remind us that it was Margaret Thatcher who coined the term TINA, there is no alternative, to which Susan George says in her most grand way, ta-ta, there are thousands of alternatives. My Susan George imitation, it's just grand. Not me, her. All right, our next speaker is Lori Wallach, who, how will I describe Lori Wallach? I will describe you as a force of nature, Lori. Dubbed the Trade Debate's Guerrilla Warrior by the National Journal, Lori is the director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, founded by Ralph Nader in 1971. Lori is a leading advocate for fair trade and investment policy, and she has represented Global Trade Watch in promoting the public interest regarding globalization and international commercial agreements in many fora such as the U.S. Congress, the courts, government agencies, and the media. A graduate of Wellesley College and Harvard Law School, Lori has testified before more than 30 congressional committees about NAFTA, GATT, and other trade proposals. Lori has authored numerous trade analyses, newspaper editorials, and her most recent book, Whose Trade Organization? Corporate Globalization and the Erosion of Democracy, and is a founding board member of the International Forum on Globalization. Please welcome Lori Wallach.
This is a kind of strange place to stand, I gotta say. I feel like I have to give an invocation. Well, folks from away, welcome to Washington. And folks from Washington, welcome to another planet. It's not just a matter for big change, seeing some funky people and not just the pinstripes around here. But on top of it, you wake up in the morning, and on the front page of the national papers, IMF, bad things. World Bank, really bad things. IMF, kills people. And you get in your car, and the radio station's news. World Bank, brrr. IMF, kills people. And you start thinking, what planet am I on? Well, if it took Seattle for most people in America to realize that WTO was not the call letters of their local radio station, the past week leading up to this weekend has dragged the World Bank and the IMF from out under their rock into the sunshine. And I have to say, sisters and brothers, the Battle of Washington, frankly, has already been won. The whole country The whole country's gotten the education we all came here to try and share, and now what's left is the mop-up operation. See you all mopping this weekend. The question is, though, the one in seriousness that Aranto raised, which is, when the protests die down, how do we keep focused with our struggle and our passion and keep the work going as intensely as the special interests and corporations who are imposing this model of corporate economic globalization on the world are working? And we're at a turning point. It's an amazing thing that's happened in the last decade. We've stopped their momentum cold. We put truth to all their power, and we stopped their momentum cold. We sacked their fast track, their NAFTA expansion, their MAI, their WTO expansion. We blew up a whole alphabet soup of their stuff. And the moment of a turning point has arrived where every little skirmish now really has enormous symbolic value. Because obviously stopping the momentum is only half the task. We have to go for the turnaround. Our slogan in Seattle was no new round, turn around. The status quo, as we're all here to make the point, is itself really bad. We've stopped it temporarily from getting worse and worse, but the status quo is not tolerable. So what I thought I would use my time here to do, because everyone here knows everything they want to know about the WTO, which was my original task, and if you don't, please buy our book, which is on sale upstairs and actually puts into clear, understandable language that's relevant to what you eat, what your job is, what the real five-year record of that set of corporate-managed trade rules called the WTO has done. And if anyone wants to battle you about it, we put 1,400 footnotes of the original site sources onto it. So you both get it understandable, but you also want to get into a fight with someone, you have footnotes to shove up their nose. So on from WTO for a moment, and instead I thought I would talk about five very specific things that you can leave here, because as I experienced the IFG teach-ins, where I learned so much from my friends and colleagues, I walk out of these events. I walk out of them scared, angry, hopeful, energized, and I want to do something with it. So for folks from the U.S. particularly, I thought I would suggest five ways to channel all of that fine energy. And it's five out of about 500 that one could come up with where urgent work needs to be done. And I hate to repeat this because a lot of people have already said it, but really there is in the U.S. both a special responsibility and also a special opportunity to do something about this system of globalization we find so unacceptable. It's a special responsibility because we're the belly of the beast. I mean, the IMF and the World Bank are here. They're down the street. That's why we're all here. It's a lot of the big multinational corporations are based here. It's been our Treasury Department and our administration after administration, whether Rep Dem or Dem Rep, that has been pushing and pushing this Washington consensus. But also, we have a thing that a lot of people don't often think of as an opportunity, but I would like to put this forward. The U.S. congressional system, not being a parliamentary system where the prime minister and the majority of the parliament are the same party, and there's nothing like actually holding individual members of Congress accountable to that slice of Americans they represent, it is here where we can do things like stop fast track. Because everyone can go back to their home communities and member by member dog the heck out of individual members of Congress until they either vote what the folks at home want or they're the next person who doesn't have a job in the global economy. And that is something we take for granted, except working with my coalition partners from around the world, we shouldn't. Because, as we know, the amazing work that happened in Canada around NAFTA, they threw out a whole government. It's like they wiped out the whole Republican Party. Two guys were left. They were the majority. And, you know, the new party that came, it was amazing. Yeah, it was worth applauding, except here's the sad story, which is the next party that comes in goes ahead and does NAFTA anyway. And the parliament there, it's not member, member, member that you're voting. They vote the party. So all of that by background of why I'm focusing on some things, as Bill Greider did, that have to do with the U.S. Congress. Now, number one thing isn't U.S. Congress specific. It's educating. It's educating to organize. And as all the people here know, because a lot of people were in Seattle, and people say, geez, what happened in Seattle? How the heck did that get organized? There wasn't any money to go into it, and you know, you guys had nothing really compared to the other side. What happened? And, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of folks who have to say, oh, it was organized very well. But actually, 70% of what caused the Seattle outrage that people put onto the street and in their hearts was the five-year record of the WTO. And it's the actual record of the World Bank and the IMF and the record of NAFTA and the record of WTO that are our strongest weapons. And I cannot emphasize enough, number one, the importance of educating ourselves, our friends, our neighbors to organize ourselves. And a resource for that, among many, is our website, which links to almost everyone else in the IFG's websites, and that is a website called tradewatch.org. As well, you'll see up in the resource room a lot of great materials, our book, other books, wonderful materials on Public Citizen's new campaign about irradiation of food as a strategy to further globalize the food supply. It is literally enough to turn your stomach materials upstairs. Now, on top of that, after 10 years in the U.S. now, citizen activism on globalization is organized certainly state by state and almost city by city. And there is a coalition called the Citizens Trade Campaign, of which Public Citizen and Friends of the Earth and IATP and many other groups are on the board. And there is a Citizens Trade Campaign state staffer in almost any state, which can tell you where your members of Congress are, will give you new materials. And you can hook into this whole operation by going into the Trade Watch website and signing up for the listserv. So educate to organize. Number two is direct accountability and direct action. And that actually is one of the lessons I left Seattle with, which is for all of our research and lobbying and scholarship, there really is what to be said about some direct action. Some, I am so mad. Some good old, I am so mad, Mr. Congressman, I've just spent 3 years trying to tell you you're a bonehead, you won't change your mind, I'm not leaving your office, literally, until you commit to X, Y, or Z. I mean, it's sad it has to come to that. The corporations have their bucks and we've got our buns and we need to plant them in some places and just stay there until we get what we want. Now, the third item is a very dire item, and it's the one that Yao Graham mentioned, the AGOA. It stands for Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, a deceptive name. It should be called what it's been nicknamed by Jesse Jackson Jr., NAFTA for Africa. Randall Robinson of TransAfrica called it the Africa Recolonization Act. It is a truly horrific piece of legislation. It's worse than NAFTA because it imposes the IMF conditionalities onto African countries to be annually certified uniquely to Africa by the U.S. President every year in order for Africa to obtain market access into the U.S. We're talking one of the most offensive pieces of trade legislation I've ever seen, and that says a lot. This is a very bad bill, and it is being pushed by a coalition of corporations led by Chevron. Their phone number for their coalition gets picked up as, hello, Ford Corporation, Washington. And their advisory board chair is Chester Crocker, the same man who designed the constructive engagement policy with the apartheid regime of South Africa. I'm not joking. So the good news was, because of the cooperative work of a huge bunch of U.S. NGOs, a huge bunch of African NGOs, the U.S. labor movement, the African labor movement, and this amazing coalition of African-American ministers around the U.S., this AGOA, which has been pushed by this big bucks coalition, had basically gotten boxed up, but it was not yet buried. And so I'm sad to say, like out of some horror flick, last night it came sliming up out of its coffin. And I am sad to report that urgent action is now required to try and not just rebox it, but bury it. The good old CEO of Chiquita Bananas, we all know him from the WTO banana case, he's the guy who came and popped all the nails off the coffin. He literally went to the Republican leadership in the dark of night last night and said, I need a special deal to really stick it to the Caribbean over that banana thing. I need this thing called rotating carousel of sanctions. I think we should revive the Africa NAFTA expansion and put it on there. And sure enough, it's back alive. This means it's going to be back in the House of Representatives. And the only good news about that is NAFTA expansion in the House of Representatives is something we can beat. So heads up, again, if you get on www.tradewatch.org, you will see action alerts, day-to-day targets, model letters to the editor, letters to Congress, and we have an 800 number to call Congress, because what we're going to have to do is get them, obviously, to vote no if this thing really does fully slither into action, which is highly probable. Okay, back to WTO for number four. The same corporations who wanted to expand WTO and were foiled in Seattle couldn't expand the agenda, now want to expand it by adding a country. And the country they want in is China. There are a lot of reasons for this corporate strategy. It is the number one priority of the National Manufacturers Association and the Chamber of Commerce to put China in the WTO and get a procedure that's called permanent normal trade relations. The big reason they want to do it is they're trying to get a win. They're trying to get a win. And they think they can split the left because they think they can have us saying, well, China, you know, China, it's a communist government, and people of the left, they want to be attacking communism, and they think they can split the left and finally revive what we've won on fast track and NAFTA expansion. This is their way. Also, though, they're very nervous because China is an outrider to the system, right? Asian financial meltdown, where has the damage not happened? The one country that doesn't have a convertible currency and has a closed market. All around, Asia melts down and China keeps growing at 7.5%. This is not a good symbol to other developing countries of do it our way, do it their way. So they're not happy to have China outside the system. And now, in China, the government elite is the economic elite. It's one and the same. And the economic elite, the government elite, they really, what they want is this permanent most favored trade relations with the U.S. What it means is a permanent, unconditional access into the U.S. market, free of any human rights or other oversight. We now have an annual oversight, and that is what is to be taken away. Now, if China goes into the WTO, its elite know, because they've published the documents, that 25 million peasant farmers will be thrown off their land in the first 5 years. So this is a very bad deal for most people in China, a very good deal for a few elites. And Congress is going to be home for the next 2 weeks where you can get them on recess, i.e. office hours. You can just stop by. They'll be there. There are literally hundreds of events. And again, you can hook into us by tradewatch.org and find the events in your area. Basically, the Turtles and the Teamsters from Seattle have added on the Tibetans, and they've hit the road. So there are lots of rallies. There are bus tours. There are Chinese democracy activists, very famous activists, who will be on bus tours around the country. Please do check our website so you can get in on it. And the final thing, which my staff will kill me if I do not mention, because it's a very important thing, is back to Geneva again, where they're all recovering from the burn of the sunshine they got in Seattle. Sunshine in Seattle, yeah, of public scrutiny. They're all thinking, all right, what are we going to do? And they've got this little built-in agenda WTO, but it's got some really rotten things in it that they already agreed they were going to do, like expand the services agreement. So our slogan was no new round, turnaround. We did the no new round part, but we haven't done the turnaround part. So a lot of the country-based campaigns, the coalitions from all over the world, had a little powwow. And basically we thought, you know, we got to go on the offensive with these guys. I mean, we got to basically tell them what they have to do by X date or they're toast. There's just no other way to get around this. We're like sick of waiting for them to announce the agenda. So let me introduce you to the WTO Shrink or Sink campaign. And there is upstairs on the info table already, it's only been in circulation for 5 days, a letter on the shrink or sink agenda. It is a whole campaign. It will be launched imminently. It's already got a couple hundred countries sign on in a week. Please get your organizations on, join the campaign. It's a very specific plan of the ways that WTO would have to be whacked back into a little teeny gadget, which we could carry around in our pockets. Thank you very much.